Omnibus is a production of iHeartRadio.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Accessed entry 138.AC1631, certificate number 39323. Bob Dylan's Christian period.
They believe that all religion is repressive and
religion is repressive to a certain degree. I mean, religion is another form of bondage which man invents to get himself to God. But that's why Christ came. Christ didn't preach religion. He preached the truth and the way and the life. He says he comes to give life and life more abundantly. He's talking about life.
Bob Dylan's Christian, period.
Bob Dylan's Christian, period. That's my Jews for Jesus t-shirt that I wear. Am I wrong in thinking that we have been a little hard on Bob Dylan on the Omnibus? Like, if your only source about the 20th century is these series of recordings, wouldn't you just think that... Because we've just said that he's a dick in Don't Look Back.
Right. He is terrible in Don't Look Back.
He's mean to reporters. He's mean to Donovan. He's mean to Donovan dressed as a reporter, wearing a hat with a label that says press in it.
I think it's easy to be hard on Dylan because he's so lionized. Everyone that should have been hard on him wasn't.
You're punching up, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
When you punch Bob Dylan.
My friend David Reese, who is a world-famous anti-skeptic, who truly believes, he's a true believer. He wrote the comic Get Your War On.
Oh, right.
But he is of the opinion that the death of Bob Dylan will, more than any other pop star, be the one that
irritates Gen X and up.
No, it will demarcate the change. When Dylan dies, everything goes with him.
Voice of his generation.
That's right. So every single publication will have it on the front page. It will be like Lady Diana, except there will be 7 million times more critical reappraisal of his catalog and his significance.
We've already lost two Beatles. I mean, we have the experience.
Well, and so that's the argument against this idea of Dylan is, well, no, Paul McCartney really is the bigger, but he says no. No, no, no. We've already lost two Beatles. McCartney will get, you know, he'll get a good send-off.
He will probably outlive Ringo at least.
Hard to know, though. Ringo just...
Do you have a plan?
Ringo just pieces his way through everything.
Ringo looks younger every time I see a picture of him. What's he doing?
I don't know. Ringo could be... I mean, Ringo has never exerted himself, least of all playing the drums
Beatles. But if you want to live a long time, shouldn't you play a little tennis or something?
I mean, he still gets out, but I guess Paul McCartney does too. Paul still does 3.5-hour shows.
Paul's a vegetarian.
Paul's a vegetarian.
And Paul did fewer drugs.
Oh, well, Paul would argue that, no, he was right there doing the drugs. That's one of the things about Paul is that he has very little sense of how it looks when someone praises John Lennon and he has to step in and say, well, you knew, I did it too.
I was there too. What is that voice?
That was not a good Paul voice.
So who's the last? It depends on who the last Beatle will be. Like, if Ringo is the last Beatle, then, you know, nobody's going to be beating their breast and putting on sackcloth and ashes for Ringo.
He'll be on the cover of Time, probably. But yeah, it's not.
Time will not exist.
There's not.
Possibly the concept of time will not exist.
But Paul.
Time will be a flat circle.
I think
the staple will be in the middle.
That's right. Time will be a Mobius strip clock.
Newsweek will be a flat circle.
The thing about Paul is we've already evaluated Paul all the way, but Dylan remains a mystery.
He's an enigma.
He really is. Did you read the story? It wasn't that long ago that he got picked up by the cops in some like New Jersey beach town, like a blue collar beach town, just because he was walking around late at night in a hoodie, just peeping in windows. And somebody called the cops on this weirdo, and they came and grabbed, you know, picked him up, and he was like, "Oh, it's Bob Dylan." And he was just like, "Oh yeah, I was out for a walk or whatever."
Oh yeah,
hey, this is what I like to do.
Well, on the one hand, I like an old white person getting arrested just for wearing a hoodie. Seems only fair.
Sure,
but also, why is he looking in windows?
I mean,
he just wants material for his music.
It might have been just one of those small towns where the houses are close to the street, so you can't help but look in the windows.
What if his next album is all like songs from New Jersey living rooms, and they're watching American Idol, but they're watching it on TiVo?
You know, those New Jersey beach towns are like, it's like they're blue collar places.
Springsteen territory. Springsteen probably called the cops.
Yeah, he was like, hey.
He's like, hey, Bob, come over. And then he's like, hey, there's going to be this weirdo on the corner.
Well, Springsteen is part of that generation of artists that we forget were Dylan ripoff artists.
Dylan is, in the period we're going to be discussing in the early 80s, a lot of Dylan's onstage comments are like, well, that's what they say about Springsteen. Like, he's obviously, clearly, like, the idea that there's a new Dylan topping the charts really looms large. And I think there's a story of him meeting the boss and saying, hey, what's the line? I'm going to script the line.
Are we going to call him the boss? Is that how you're going to play this episode out? Every time we refer to Springsteen, you're like, well.
Or, as I call him.
The boss.
The chairman of the board. And he says something, I think he says something to Springsteen like, I used to be you, or something like that.
Well, I mean, if you think about
it. No, I know. I got it. Tell the story correctly.
Go ahead.
I hear you're the new me.
Oh, you're the new me.
I hear you're the new me.
That's a kick in the pants.
It's a little cutting, Bob.
But and especially by 1980, he'd been the new Bob for like 8 years by then. But if you think about him with his beard and his floppy hat and his like.
And his fake middle American working man thing.
Yeah, the like long songs with multiple verses where there's never really it never resolves about people getting in their car. It's a more working class Dylan.
My take about Springsteen is that he is deeply cheesy.
Oh, ooh, you're coming out just full swinging at the boss.
And I have been told by Springsteen fans that is not a fair take. But really, I mean, when you think of the appeal of this guy, you know, the fans will lionize, you know, the stripped down, spare lyrics of instrumentation of Nebraska,
right,
or the social commentary on, you know. But, you know, to see him in concert where he's kind of yucking it up with Clarence and there's big cheesy saxophone solos.
Clarence is gone now. Of course, we can't besmirch his memory.
It's Clarence's son. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, the new sax guy is Clarence's son. How great is that?
It's great.
I love when that happens.
It's just like when Zach Starkey plays in Led Zeppelin. Yeah.
Can you imagine Time Magazine when Zach Starkey dies? but Dylan is not cheesy. If, you know, you can't say that.
I don't know. That's the problem with Dylan. What can you say? I mean, this is why when he dies, it will just be one think piece after another. Did you read his autobiography?
Confessions? Or is that what it's called?
No. What's it called? It's like, it's volume one. It's Chronicles.
Chronicles. There we go. Not Confessions. I did.
Chronicles volume one.
I'm eagerly waiting volume two.
I know, me too. It's like the Traveling Wilburys. I can't wait for volume three.
They skipped volume two.
It's an amazing book. Really great read.
Good writer. Good storyteller.
It tells stories it's not chronological. It tells stories across his whole career.
Most of the book is about Oh Mercy from 1989, weirdly.
Right. He's super down on Daniel Lanois.
Right.
And it's hilarious. And it did that amazing thing, which is it made him more mysterious, not less, because of just the structure of it and how you would choose it. How do you choose to write that?
The question about Dylan to me is how much of that is calculated?
Well, but refusing to accept the Nobel Prize? I mean, it's ridiculous that they nominated him. You can see a bunch of Swedish boomers
exactly.
who are just like, oh, we'll give it to Dylan.
Or as we call them, the boomers.
But the idea that they would give him the Nobel Prize for Literature is like an insult to everyone. It's retroactively an insult to Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Is it worse than when Obama got the Peace Prize after being in office for like 4 months?
But not as bad as Henry Kissinger getting the Peace Prize. But for him to refuse it, what is in, I guess you could say, is like the ultimate honor. Is there a higher human honor than the Nobel Prize for Literature?
You know, he didn't, you know, he was making noises about how he wasn't going to show up and so forth. He did, in fact, finally accept it after a lot of back and forth.
Oh, he did?
Yes, but it was all very fraught. Like Dylan saying he's not going to come to the ceremony, he's never going to come. What is that in service of? You just want to be an outsider when you're in your 70s and have a Kennedy Center honor and a...
He's churlish. He's always been churlish. And that is something in our culture that we still admire. We admire churlishness if the catalog backs it up.
Yeah, I mean, we're fascinated by the fact We're fascinated by the fact that we don't get him, that he's a chameleon, that he keeps changing.
This is the thing about Oasis, right? The Oasis came on the scene and they were pre-churlish. They already had a bad attitude and they hadn't done anything. And then they made some records that, you know, that some would argue were middling.
They're pretty good. You don't like the Oasis records?
Not very much. I mean, they're fine.
I was listening to Blur on our road trip last week.
Blur I like.
And I was listening to Blur and I was like, you know, I want to be a Blur guy and there's no song on here that's as good as any song on Wonderwall. What's the Story of Morning Glory or...
Well, which one were you listening to? Like
I had Park Life. I had Park Life on, which is a great album. And I really wish that I liked the songs better than Oasis songs. And I'm a slave to...
The thing about Britpop is they forgot the pop about half the time. They made a bunch of stuff that sounded like the Kinks, but the Kinks knew how to write songs. And those guys kind of didn't.
Park Life is such a Kinks record. I was noticing that this time.
But Dylan...
Back to Dylan.
I don't understand how... I mean, Paul McCartney talks about when they saw Dylan at Royal Albert Hall, and I think it was Lennon more than Paul that was just like, the audience was quiet. There was no screaming. They listened to him like it was a religious service. And Lennon wanted that.
Because he had literary pretensions. He thought of himself as a poet. And so this guy's actually doing it. This guy's getting mass crowds for these dense elliptical lyrics.
Right.
And John goes home and writes Norwegian Wood, I guess.
And you know, they were the most famous band in the world, but it was not the fame they wanted.
It was teens.
But Paul didn't mind teens. He never minded teens.
They were a boy band.
And what Paul didn't learn from Dylan is be a little churlish every once in a while. Like, for the love of God, stop.
He doesn't have it in him.
Stop pandering
so hard.
Stop
doing that little ooh face, Paul.
But I should be more of a Dylanologist than I am.
Do you feel like you're not?
Not nearly enough.
It's an intimidating canon.
Yes.
There's hundreds of works, and fans know about thousands of more works, and you have to know all these different names and dates.
And if Dylan is the crossover artist. Like, if you buy those British, like hi-fi magazines, or if you buy Sound on Sound or whatever, some British snob music magazine, they will talk about Dylan where they would never talk about the Beatles or hardly would.
Well, prophets without honor in his own country, you know?
But I mean, Dylan is also jazz. I mean, he's also pure folk, if you want to call him that, but he's also like revolutionary. He's like Miles Davis of the three chords.
So many reinventions, right? You know, famously plugging in at the Newport Folk Festival. Mm-hmm. And today we're just like, so what's the big deal? Well, of course, a couple of these songs are going to have electric guitar, but no, that was against everything that folk stood for.
Everything.
And then after the motorcycle accident, kind of reinventing himself as kind of a acoustic, you know, the basement tapes and kind of a pared down rustic sound, which turns into straight up country on Nashville Skyline. And then those Daniel Lanois records to be reborn in the 90s.
Oh, but you forget the whole period where he painted his face white and did, you know, this traveling vaudeville show where he's driving a GMC RV around the country.
So this is right on the heels of that. In the late 70s, Bob Dylan pulled off perhaps his most surprising reinvention when he became a born-again Christian.
It still resonates across the world.
It still seems weird because you know it existed, but you're like, wait, really? Like, as a bit?
As a bit, right.
But for three records, trilogy of records.
How much still to this day do you suspect it's a bit?
I kind of assumed it was because he's a troll. He was one of the earliest trolls. He took pleasure in finding out what would piss off a bunch of folkies, what would make some dingus at the Royal Albert Hall yell Judas at him. And then he would do that. And he would say things in interviews just to piss people off. He was capricious. And it's what you hate about him in Don't Look Back, that he likes to get a rise out of people.
Right. But the thing about it in Don't Look Back, one of the things that makes it unbearable is that you also don't feel he's quite as clever as he has the pretense that he is, right? I mean, the Beatles in those interviews where 60 guys in tab collars were shoving microphones in their face and saying like, well, the Americans are not going to like you. What do you say to that?
What do you call your haircut?
And the Beatles are hilarious.
They've got a good joke for every question.
Yeah, but they're also, they're throwing it back at him. And Dylan just kind of says these cryptic things that are mean. And also, they just feel like a churlish teenager could come up with that. Like, oh, well, you know, what about your mom or whatever? You know, it's not as funny as you want.
Well, isn't that the guy who should find Jesus? Like, don't we need these churlish people examining their souls?
I see what you're
saying.
Their
black souls.
He looked for it in every kind of dysfunction, and then he got on the straight and narrow.
It's difficult to, so the story of, we can now reconstruct the story of Dylan's conversion in 1978.
From documents at the time.
The archaeological record. Well, it was all a little, he refused to talk about it.
Sure.
For the most part.
That's
and I think
Dylan.
He was wise to do so. Because the last thing you want from, you know, we say he's cryptic, but do you really want that guy being sincere and pouring out his heart? That's one of the weirdest things about his conversion.
Well, now let me ask you this. Isn't one of the doctrines of being a Christian to spread the word about being a Christian?
He is absolutely doing what a good Christian should do when he makes three, you know, maybe mediocre records.
Oh, I see. That's his testimony.
That's his testimony. Oh. And because the records are not subtle at all, as we will see. Uh-huh. But his career is at a low point in the late 70s. Street Legal has been a huge flop.
A huge flop because it didn't have the tunes.
Yeah, it's a, you know, name one song. Even if you're a Dylanologist, name one song on Street Legal. It's not his most fertile creative.
It came out in the disco era.
Yes, it doesn't. I don't think it sounds disco. But
no, but that's the thing.
It's forgettable.
Disco and punk rock were moving things along. Right. You know, this was also a kind of fallow period for Neil Young, but he took it, you know, all the way to like a doo-wop record. And then he made Trans, which was all like through a vocoder. Like he
could have just found Jesus.
He kept moving.
It's much easier. but I think Bob's also drinking too much. He has just divorced his wife, Sarah, and it's an ugly divorce. She claims, most likely because of his ugly behavior, she claims in one of the proceedings that she came down to breakfast one morning and he's there with the kids and his girlfriend.
Whoa.
With whom he spent the night. Poor Jacob of the Wallflower sitting there. Eating his honeycomb.
Just like, one day I'm going to write a pop song.
And he comes down, and I think it's this very morning, he hits her in the jaw and tells her to leave.
Whoa, out of her own house.
Yeah, out of her own house in her telling of the story.
Out of her big brass bed.
So he's lost the... right. Lee, lady, Lee. So he loses the kids in a custody battle. His Rolling Thunder review... years end in a four-hour movie called Ronaldo and Clara that he makes with Sam Shepard, which no one likes or wants.
Did you like that period? Because he wrote some epic.
I like Desire.
Dylan songs.
You know,
right?
Desire has, I guess Hurricane is not my favorite song, but you know, there are good songs from that era.
ISIS.
Do you like ISIS? I like Mozambique.
Yeah. I mean, we used to listen to them on tour. Because you could just put that record on and you know, after 20 minutes, you'd be like, is this the same song? It is, right?
There is something kind of, you know.
Still good.
You think Dylan is the father of kind of trancey music? Where, because that's happened to me. And I think there is something that separates me from a true Dylanologist. Because I will put on a Dylan record and enjoy it. I don't mind the voice. I don't mind the harmonica. I can see the craft in the songwriting. And it really is just all seem like one kind of long song.
What's cool about him is that his vocal, his vocal cadence kind of trips along, and his guitar chords don't come. It's not just 1-4-5 over and over. Like it feels almost like he's changing the chords on the guitar to suit what he's saying, rather than having his vocals follow a set pattern. So it does have this kind of tumbling, somersaulting feel where you're never sure really, I mean, until he starts singing the chorus, you're never really sure where he is in any given verse or any given moment. You cannot in Dylan easily predict, like, here comes the chorus, because he's doing this.
And if you've ever seen him live, he accentuates that by making it impossible to sing along, even if you know the song.
Well, now
he will reinvent it on the fly, just so
crazy.
That, yeah, just so that nobody can know what's going to happen next.
His live shows now are an act of like aggressive contempt for his audience.
I've seen him do most of his show with his back to the crowd.
Yeah,
which is,
and he's just like mumbling and or sitting at the piano for the whole show.
I wonder if some of the appeal of listening to those records is not unlike the podcasting appeal in our era, where you feel like you're hanging out with somebody. Like, they're not performing. You just feel like you're kind of in the room with Dylan as he talks and scats and then noodles on the harmonica for a second. You know, like, because he doesn't have a vocalist's voice, you know?
But he hits these emotional high points that few ever do. And he does it routinely. And it's just a combination of the sadness in his voice, the sort of casual, his casual flow, and then some beautiful couplet of words where you're like, oh, well, that just killed me for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah.
And he does it over and over and over again. And that, I think, is what contributes to this feeling like he's a prophet. He's a monk.
He must know something we don't know.
Yeah. He's a deacon in some crazy church that he won't reveal, which made the Christian thing that much crazier.
Because people wanted to know the secret. Like, he did not want to be the voice of a generation, and everyone wanted him to be that prophet and tell him what to do and who to vote for and what to do in Vietnam.
Right.
And he hated that.
And the fact that he's Jewish adds this sort of Kabbalic mystical element for mainstream America. Like, oh, he's a, you know, he's come from an ancient line. He's a Cohen, although he's not. But, you know, like that feeling that he has arrived through Minneapolis or through, you know, through Duluth.
Where you're like, a thriving Duluth synagogue.
Say
I'm
what
sure.
now?
So he's having a hard 1970s.
His hard 70s, yeah.
Yeah. Once upon a time, he looked so fine. He threw the bumps of dime in his prime. But, you know, and in hindsight, he talks about how he felt empty. You know, the crowds were still there, but he would leave the show just feeling empty. I'm sure it's not an uncommon sentiment for musicians. He's probably the only person ever to think that. But he happens to be at a show in San Diego in November 1978 where some random person in his telling throws a silver cross up on the stage. And for whatever reason, he just grabs the cross and sticks it in his pocket.
Does it burn?
Yeah. Do you think that's what happens when a person of the Jewish persuasion touches a cross, John?
I never touch a cross on the rare chance that it'll burn me.
Do you think Bob Dylan is a vampire? Yes or no? Answer the question.
They seem like dangerous weapons in the wrong hands.
The next night he's doing, or a couple nights later, he's doing a show in Arizona, and he's gone from bad to worse. He's, you know, in the dressing room backstage. And
still wearing the same shirt.
Existential crisis. Well, same pants apparently, because he reaches in his pocket and sees the cross. And he has kind of a mystical experience. Hmm. And he says that later, you know, later describing what happened to him in his hotel room that night, he says, Jesus did appear to me and is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he did die on the cross for all mankind.
Whoa.
He calls it a knee-buckling experience. Like, he describes it as kind of a road to Damascus, you know, reckoning with the reality of Jesus and Christianity.
Now, let me ask you this. This is a personal question. But as someone who grew up in a faith, who has maintained that faith, have you ever had what you would describe as a truly mystical experience?
I would say very, very rarely, and I would never kind of use that kind of knee buckling, saw the light kind of language.
Well, you already were in the light.
It does seem, it's true that when you're surrounded by water like a fish, you know, maybe you're less likely to have that kind of, whoa, this is a new emotion kind of thing.
Because I have had that experience. a mystical and conversion experience. And it's what helped me get sober.
I see. So yours is not necessarily religious in nature.
It was, though.
There's a higher power.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with getting sober and the thing that so many people who are using drugs who don't want to really get sober yet, the main complaint of the sort of Alcoholics Anonymous version of it is that it requires that you believe there's something bigger than you.
Which seems less and less relevant every day.
Yeah, and it does, but it doesn't specify what that can be. You know, it could be
the Coca-Cola company.
Anything that has the capacity to share some of your burden. Something other than your own intelligence and your own will.
Could it be an abstract concept? Could it be Absolutely. Love? Could it be a sense of oneness with my fellow man and Absolutely. The universe? And okay.
Something just to bear some of the responsibility for the world and by extension, your path through it, other than just you and your overwhelming smartness and power.
It's going to be hard for the new atheists, I think.
Well, and it was.
I hope they stay off the.
It was
stay off the hard stuff.
Really hard for me, as it is, I think, for a lot of addicts, because you know you really do believe that you're the one that sees most clearly, right? That's one of the paradoxes of being high on drugs is that you think you've got the real picture, and everybody else is living in a dream or living, you know, the rest of the sheep are asleep in the world, right? And so when I had that, I mean, I had a similar kind of moment where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. And I mean, almost the light from the moon penetrated the forest where I happened to be standing calf deep in snow, or I'm sorry, thigh deep in snow. And it was just like, oh, and I mean, I'm not a religious person, but it was profound and transformative. And that was the last night I ever did drugs.
I feel like when I've had those experiences, like they have felt meaningful in that they have felt like not rational and coming from outside myself, but they have been more subtle than what Dylan describes here.
Well, and most people I don't think are looking for a conversion from one empty, soulless plod to a life full of meaning. I think most people are like, well, there's some meaning in my life already, and I'm not ready to sell it all.
One of the things that seems to have led Dylan from this moment of epiphany to a new lifestyle is, and this is maybe an underreported part of the story, that he has always apparently been very appreciative of Black women.
Oh, that's not really in evidence in the women he's publicly chosen to couple with.
Apparently he has had a series of secret relationships, even a secret wife, I think, in the 80s, and a series of children. Then these have all sprung from his habit of dating his backup singers.
Wow.
And so he's got a series of relationships with backup singers who come from Christian backgrounds, many of them still practicing.
In his employ.
Right. Which I mean,
complicates things.
Like, there's really nothing about this story that makes him look good in the fact that he's a serial secret marrier and dater of his backup singers.
But over the course of his career, many, many people presumably have told him he needs Jesus.
Right.
You know what? You need Jesus, Bob.
And in this time in particular, he's dating a series of his kind of, you know, the backup singers who sing, session singers who sing kind of gospel inflected backup stuff on his records and in concerts.
Which was the style at the time.
Right. A woman named Clydie King, a woman named Helena Springs. Carolyn Dennis is the one I think he secretly married in the 80s and has a child with.
Do any of these women appear in the movie 20 Feet from Stardom or whatever?
Oh, I don't think so. But these women recommend, you know, praying and scripture to him. And I think there's one in particular, an actor, not one of his singers, but a Black woman he's dating named Mary Alice Artes, an actress, who says, oh, I'm going to this great evangelical church in the Valley. You should come with me to Vineyard Fellowship. And it turns out somehow that a couple of his Muscle Shoals backup guys, including T-Bone Burnett, are also going to Vineyard Fellowship.
Whoa.
In the late 70s. These guys all have their little Sunday school that they've been going to. And Dylan has no intention of going to services, but, you know, one morning he just sits bolt upright at 7 a.m. and thinks, okay, I'll go to their Bible class,
okay,
I guess.
I'm going
to Bible class. What if he does talk like that all the time?
I think he does.
Maybe.
You know, this plot line is what ruined the book A Walk Across America. There's a wonderful, there's three quarters of a wonderful book called A Walk Across America, where a guy sets out from New England to walk across America. And I read it, you know, when I discovered the title, I was like, amazing, this is it.
That you are a walker across things.
I love this. This was before I'd really walked across that many things.
Did this help you walk across more and bigger things?
It did, reading the book. But unfortunately, he walks down the East Coast, down through Appalachia, down to the South somewhere. He has a dog, like a husky dog or something. The dog dies. He's sad. And he walks past a revival church, you know, a tent revival. Or maybe he's staying with somebody and they're like, come to church with us. And he does. And the light comes down. And it's just like the scene in the Blues Brothers where Elwood does the somersaults up the aisle. And then he immediately stops walking across America, and it becomes like a book about his Christian conversion.
He's on a mission from God.
And it's just like, wait a minute, this isn't a walk across America. You like walk through four states.
Bait and switch.
Oh,
I hate that.
This guy. So anyway.
So Dylan starts going to this church in Tarzana and Bible study in Reseda. And
did this make the newspapers?
Not at the time. Not until he went public, which happened shortly thereafter. But apparently, in his accounts of it, the scriptures seem to mean a lot to him. Like, I guess as a literary person himself, and somebody who kind of sings these prophetic-sounding texts, I guess seeing the original
sure
appears to really speak to his soul.
Sure, it's like reading Shakespeare in jail.
And he appears to take it as fact, you know, that, well, hey, this is, you know, Jesus said he's coming back, so watch out.
Were his parents devout Jews?
More so than him. I guess he never practiced. But when his mom hears the news that he's now a proud parishioner of Vineyard Fellowship, you know, above a real estate office in Reseda, she's pretty mad.
But he was bar mitzvahed.
Yes. And I think she starts sending rabbis over to like kind of try to talk him down.
Oh, wow. It's like a scene from The Exorcist.
Right. Or Annie Hall, backwards. But he's very convinced. Another thing that convinces him is these books by this guy named Hal Lindsey. Do you remember this phenomenon?
What were the books?
Evangelical guy who in the late 70s comes to believe that because Israel has been restored to Palestine, that the end of the world is now imminent.
Oh, sure. This is a very popular doctrine among evangelicals now.
It is. And very specific, you know, he's the guy that kind of, he's patient zero for a lot of this stuff about how in the vision of the book of Daniel, when there's the statue has 10 toes, that represents the European Economic Community. And that's the last step of the new Roman Empire before Christ comes again. This is stuff that was all taught to me as fact on worksheets when I went to a Methodist elementary school. And I come to find out it comes from this Hal Lindsey guy who's predicting that Jesus is going to come back in the 80s.
Well, and this is why the Hasidim live in Brooklyn and only speak Yiddish, because the idea of...
They're scared of Hal Lindsey?
Well, no, the idea of speaking Hebrew as a language in Israel, that is only meant to happen after the Messiah comes back. And so to do it before, to make Hebrew the state language of Israel it's haram.
I didn't realize that. I don't think they would probably not use the word haram. What do they have? Trafe? Is that right?
It's Trafe, right.
I didn't realize that it was a choice not to. Do they believe that they would actually invoke the apocalypse? Were they to speak too much Hebrew? Or is it just like you gotta
I feel like it's bad voodoo. I mean, you can, you know, you use Hebrew as a religious language, but you don't use it as a mercantile one, certainly. So Yiddish survives.
It would be funny if they all had like a Hebrew dictionary, but like behind glass with like in a case of fire, you know, in case.
I think they all know Hebrew pretty
well. In case of
well.
Messiah, break glass. So you know, there's this culture of, you know, how it's so important that the state of Israel be converted, you know, that the Jewish people discover their true Lord and Savior.
Oh, so this is the Jews for Jesus era.
It's the Jews for Jesus era, exactly. And Jews for Jesus people start camping out at Bob's shows because very soon he starts doing material from his new record, Slow Train Coming, which is...
Much to the delight of all of the fans that are there to hear Like a Rolling Stone.
Rock critics hate it, and the fans are confused because... What happens is he refuses to do any old songs.
Oh, boy.
So he's got one gospel record, and he launches a nationwide tour where he only does the songs on Slow Train Coming.
This is a nightmare.
You're not a big fan of the part of the show where the guy says, we're going to do a song off the new record.
Hey, we're only going to do the new record tonight.
We got a Christian song from the new record.
Well, and especially like with his Hare Krishnas there in the lobby handing out brochures.
Handing out pamphlets.
It's like the opposite of walking through Williamsburg in 2009.
In what way? There's no yogurt stores.
There was a period, and I think it may even still be true, that in Williamsburg and the neighborhoods in Brooklyn there that had a concentration of Orthodox Jews, mm-hmm. the young Orthodox guys would stand out on the street corners and flag down hipsters, because the neighborhood was polluted with hipsters.
Yeah.
They would flag down hipsters that looked Jewish and say, "Are you Jewish?" And if you were, they would say, you need to get right with God. And they'd try to convert, you know, like just innocent Jewish hipster kids walking around Brooklyn.
To Orthodox Judaism.
Yeah. And if you weren't Jewish like me, I mean, I had a beard.
Did they let you go with a warning?
And I would say like, no. And they'd just be like, you don't, you know, keep moving. It's just like when you walk past somebody from the Nation of Islam handing out the newspaper. They're not looking at me, right?
Whitey can walk on by.
Yeah, they're not trying to hand one to me.
Every song on Slow Train Coming is explicitly based on a scriptural text, in the way a preacher would base his sermon on 2 Corinthians, 2:11 or whatever.
That's an interesting literary device.
And it's not even "Gotta Serve Somebody," which is the big hit. You know, it's a biblical text, and it's an interesting song because, you know, this is the guy who for decades said, you know, don't follow leaders, watch the parking meters. I'm not here to give you the answers. And now he's like, guess what? You got to serve somebody. I'm going to tell it to you straight now. It might be the devil or it might be the Lord.
Was it a hit?
It was a big hit. It was his first hit in 3 years. He won his first Grammy.
Wow. Forgot to serve somebody. And was it overtly understood in the press? Had he already publicized his conversion and it was already a problem for everybody and then he had a hit? Or was this kind of the way that the story got introduced?
No, he had already been very publicly Christian in his live shows and talking about the new record. And all you'd have to do is listen to the record once, because it's not the ambiguous kind of Christian rock. I was getting my haircut with my son in just a barbershop in our Seattle neighborhood the other day, and we had been sitting waiting for about 5 minutes, and I realized that the Christian rock station was on in the salon.
Yeah.
And because it's just kind of a, you know, and I need you so much, you know, all these kind of generic lyrics.
You're my one true love. You can't tell if
you can't tell if the Y in you has a capital Y or not, you know? But then I'm like, Dylan, I think these guys are thinking, I think they're singing about Jesus and not about a lady, a nice lady.
I was at the state fair last summer and there was this amazing troupe of contemporary ballet. It was all women and they were dressed in very gauzy outfits and they were doing this. I mean, they took up the entire stage with their—
That's your favorite kind of outfit, right?
Well, I like a gauzy outfit, but also they were doing this very sort of sweeping kind of ethereal movements.
Let the record show that John is mimicking this right now.
Just back and forth with this swoopy— And it was beautiful. I was captivated. And I sat in the chair and watched it. Oh, and they were in pastels. And I was just like, what am I seeing? This is who in our world today spends this much time making art that isn't ever going to be profitable, right? This isn't a thing that nobody's going to get famous from this, but they're incredible. Like I kind of imagined that maybe I would hire them to do this behind my band while I sang my sad indie rock songs, because it would be a huge hit. And I was there for 40 minutes before I realized that this was a Jesus cult and that they were doing this.
Or Christianity, as it's called now. Do you still call— are you like in the Roman Empire? You still call it a Jesus cult?
But there was something very culty about it. Like dancers would come on and off the stage, and the ones that were off the stage were still visible, both to the audience and to the people on stage. And they were doing the hands of praise, which at first I took to be
touchdown.
Well, and part of the dance, like a gesture of the dance. Cause I don't have the vocabulary of like how high your hand has to be in the air, like where it switches from a Sieg Heil to a like praise Jesus. I don't know what the angle is.
Mormons are pretty low church. We don't have any of that.
You don't raise your hands up in the air.
No.
And wave them like you just don't care, because you care.
We care too much for that kind of thing. But anyway, like Slow Train Coming is not that kind of a stealth Christian record. Like here's the lyrics on one song. Jesus said, "Be ready, for you know not the hour in which I come." He said, "He who is not for me is against me," just so you know where he's coming from. Like, like it's not, you know, it's pretty easy to see that Bob Dylan has had a change of heart.
Yeah, right.
When those are the lyrics.
Well, it seems a little bit militant, right? He's got a bandolier on.
Well, that's what happens. I mean, the record is preachy in the literal sense that he has discovered something that he thinks everyone needs, and he wants them to be saved too. I think Ginsberg came backstage at one of the shows and said, "Man, I thought you were going to be a Christian like William Blake." Like, you know, like he thought Dylan was going to be visionary, and Ginsberg was kind of, Ginsberg was annoyed that it was actually, that it was anger and what, justice.
I imagine that, and judgment. We're talking about Allen Ginsberg here, not Justice Ginsberg.
Not Justice Ginsberg. She was not at the show.
But I'm sure futurelings are like, wait, those are different people. But I bet Allen Ginsberg had other things to be upset about.
Great Halloween couple costume idea. Allen Ginsberg and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I thought you were going to say Allen Ginsberg and Christian Dylan.
But the record also has dopey songs as well. But, you know, Gotta Serve Somebody's, I think, is a solid song.
It's a good song.
It's on Dylan Greatest Hits collections to this day. But it's also got songs like Man Gave Names to All the Animals, which is kind of a children's reggae number.
Sure.
God Gave Names to, which is routinely called like the worst song in the Dylan canon. And it's just kind of a goofy children's Sunday school song about how, you know, Adam saw one that wasn't too small and he wasn't too big, so he called it a pig. You know, it's exactly what you would imagine, you know, kids singing at their Christian youth camp.
Kids love reggae, though. You
gotta, if there's one thing that's true then and now, kids love reggae.
You got to serve somebody.
But, you know, this record gets a great review. Jan Wenner loves this record in Rolling Stone.
Jan Wenner, the ultimate American critic.
But when Dylan starts touring on this, of course, you know, it's not just that he's not doing any new songs. It's that he's also doing 8-minute raps full of apocalyptic biblical imagery between the songs and ranting about how all the power Satan has.
How on drugs is he at this time?
I don't think he is.
You don't think of him as a famous druggie.
No.
Although he surely did some. I mean, if you look at the traveling shows of the 70s, he's pretty cocained.
I wonder, I mean, maybe this is still cocaine powered. I mean, it's certainly the era for it.
Right.
But he definitely has a strange intensity about his beliefs. You know, his newfound idea that you know, Christ will come back to save the Jews, like Hal Lindsey has told him, means that he's always putting down Iran because it's the time of the oil crisis and the hostage stuff. So he's always putting down Arabs from the stage and getting booed. At one point in San Francisco, he puts down like the homosexualist agenda.
Oh boy.
You know, it's trouble, but he appears to be sincere. Like at one point he's in a deposition, somebody who's one of the witnesses to the Hurricane Reuben Carter case sues Dylan for how they're portrayed in the song.
Oh,
and
sure.
Dylan had to give a deposition, and the whole thing is just him ranting about how this is now Satan's kingdom now, and Satan has power, and you can't put your treasure in the earth where moth doth corrupt. So the tour is kind of a fiasco. Rock critics write, you know, very
scathing.
Yeah, scathingly, ungenerously about the shows. Ticket sales are low. He has to book smaller theaters. Places where in London people had camped out for 72 hours to buy tickets the year before, now there's empty seats. When the tour starts in San Francisco, and Bob's good friend George Harrison comes to see him, and after seeing the show, checks out of the hotel the same night to avoid having to talk to Dylan.
Oh,
after.
Ouch.
And
you know, if George thinks your religion is too kooky.
That's really harsh. John didn't like it either. When John heard Gotta Serve Somebody, he wrote his own parody song called Serve Yourself.
Right.
Which explicitly is like, hey, rock star who's found Jesus or Buddha or whatever, guess what? You know, I'll tell you how it is.
So John.
That's pretty John. Confrontational answer songs. But nobody knew he wasn't going to do the old songs. So, you know, eventually protesters start holding up signs saying, Jesus loves your old songs too.
Oh, protesters.
But Christian groups start coming. They're so happy. Sure. You know, they've got one of their own now.
And this is before Christian rock was a thing.
Yes. So they've got nothing in the popular sphere.
Christian rock now is a huge business, a $1 billion business.
Big industry. Do you remember the movie they made about how your favorite Christian rock song got written? There's some I just saw a trailer for a movie last year about the story behind the song that changed 100 million lives. And I'm like, I have never heard this one or whatever this Christian rock classic is called.
Because it's really big, but it's behind a paywall.
It's in its own little, behind a paywall. Baptism's not a paywall, John. So Dylan plays these shows to stunned silence. The maybe applauding Christian church groups next to just old-timey fans that just wanted to smoke up and are now pissed that he's not going to do like a Rolling Stone or Masters of War or whatever.
People out there are banging their tambourines and the old crusties are like, get me out of here.
The promoters are just begging him for one old song and he won't do it. And in fact, like there's a whole, for the middle of the show, I think he leaves and there's six gospel songs performed by the backup singers, several of whom may be sleeping with the closing act. And, people boo them every night. I've already been to church.
Well, now, is there not a Dylan song that he could own? Didn't he write? I mean, he was always writing sort of cryptically in a way that could be interpreted as mystically.
I mean, that's the weird thing about folk. In Europe, folk ballads are mostly about, about sex, right? It's always, I went riding on the heath, I found my true love,
jingle,
Molly McCready, or whatever. Or about putting down the Lord in his castle. They're all about uprisings for the common man.
American folk is generally about how the working class is going to take ownership of the means of production.
Thank goodness, one of these days. But it's also religious, right? Because it's been tinged by spirituals, So you've got all your Michael Rowe, The Boat Ashore. And in fact, the first Peter, Paul, and Mary record, the first Simon and Garfunkel record, these all have classic spirituals on it. They have Go Tell It on the Mountain and This Train is Bound for Glory on them.
But it was done in earnest as an appreciation of the musical form, but not
out of devotion.
You never really get the sense that Paul Simon is like,
right. Go Tell It on the Mountain. It is weird now to listen to those guys say that Jesus Christ is born, which we think of as like kind of a Christmas carol. But there is a rich religious tradition in folk that he could have drawn on. I think from his earlier albums do have some of those, traditional folk and spiritual songs.
Right.
But I guess he thought it's mostly symbolic. I'm a new person.
Right.
Like I've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. I'm a new person. And so this is Satan that wants me to do the old stuff. I'm not that guy anymore.
Actually washed in the blood of a lamb, I can say that it's not as great as it sounds.
That's how Ringo Starr stays young.
Yeah. That stuff dries,
he said, I don't sing any song which hasn't been given to me by the Lord to sing. So he kind of felt like he's been inspired.
Well, what's interesting is that a lot of songwriters, and I think probably Dylan too, if you really scratch the surface of it, we all credit some kind of ether for our best songs because they're...
Where did they come from?
Yeah, you often sit down at the piano and you write one of your best compositions in the space of time it takes to put pencil to paper. And you go, what the heck was that? I almost had no input in it at all. It just came out.
It's not problem solving in any way.
No, you're not like, how do I go to the chorus? It's just like kapow. And it's not uncommon at all for a songwriter to say, well, that's just, it just floated down. The song already existed. All I had to do was pull it down from the sky. And I've never heard Dylan talk about that, but the Lord gives us every song to sing. Well, that's not true. Some of them I really work hard on.
Well, it feels like the Lord gave him better material in the early 60s before his conversion.
Boy, I'm telling you.
The succeeding, so there, he records three full-on gospel records, much to the consternation of CBS.
This is exactly, that's a very good point you just made. If the Lord wants to get his message across, well, you 3-minute pop songs, buddy. Like, that's what I like about you by the Romantics. That's, if that was about Jesus.
Like, Goffin and King are my disciples, not Bob Dylan. So he records two other records, Saved and Shot of Love, which are not classics. They're kind of, with the exception of Every Grain of Sand on Shot of Love, which is just an amazing kind of, one of these kind of hymn-like songs that feels discovered, like you say.
Yeah.
They are not great. They're kind of haphazardly made. The stories of him in the studio. I mean, Slow Train Coming has Mark Knopfler on it, which is funny. He didn't know he was going to be doing a gospel record, but he got roped into this. You want to work with Bob Dylan? Yeah. But Slow Train Coming, he just makes with some of his session guys and his girl groups. And he doesn't seem that interested. At one point, he just disappears for 4 days, goes to Laguna Beach, leaves the band just sitting in the studio.
He's just walking around with a hoodie on, peeping in people's
peeping
windows.
In windows of Laguna Beach. He just eventually the monitor mixes from the day, you know, at the end of the day, or end up on the record.
Huh.
Because the producer keeps wanting to, like, you know, clean everything up and make it, you know, kind of tweak it and make it sound nice. You know all the terminology there.
That you said it just perfectly.
That's exactly what musicians say.
The producer wanted to tweak it and make it sound nice.
He wants a more polished mix, and Dylan's like, no, yeah, we're going to use the monitor mixes. Yeah. You know, he doesn't want to. He's mercurial, that guy.
Or a dick, as we've also suggested, is another way to put it.
And he leaves off songs like Caribbean Wind, which, you know, would have been an actual great song on that record. But in the live shows, he starts mixing in oldies again.
Oh, that's nice.
And so what happens is, even though his conversion is overnight, his kind of return to secular music
slips sliding away.
It's gradual. Yeah, it's like a Rolling Stone. You know, it's a slow move. And he never actually repudiates his religious years. You know, as late as the 90s, he'd get asked about it, and he'd be like, oh, no, to me, Oh Mercy is kind of a gospel record. He says, music should aim for the soul, not the groin. I think you can hear the gospel influence in Oh Mercy.
Huh.
So he's, you know, he never said, yeah, boy, what was I thinking? But maybe you wouldn't.
No, that's not Dylan's way.
Well, it's not the human way to be like, oh, boy, I sure got snookered by Vineyard Fellowship.
No, I confess all my mistakes.
Is that you're a confessional musician, but Dylan is not.
Right.
He's cryptic, you know?
Well, but I feel like maybe coming to an understanding that you are not the genius, you're not the boy genius of the world, which I think he probably labored under for many years, because everybody that he met told him that. That probably is transformative if you can stick with it and improves the quality of your life.
Maybe that's what he kept with him. It's certainly true that, you know, this kind of material does not play to his strengths. You know, he's a poet, right? There are shades of meaning and subtlety. And when you're writing songs called Property of Jesus, where you've got a, you know, where you're essentially a pitch man, you've got a message to get out there.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't, towards the end, a song like Every Grain of Sand is spiritual without being, you know, unsubtle, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the great spiritual songs are about someone who is lost, not what the secret is to getting found. I mean, you know, lost and then found.
Yeah, these songs are not reflective at all. And I think maybe that's what's missing in them.
I'm not the Dylanologist I feel like I should be. And to look at his mid to late 80s output, like, he hooked up with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers sometime immediately after this. And I think got reinvigorated in rock and roll because Tom Petty loved him so much. And he had this, you know, the Heartbreakers at the time, one of the great backing bands.
Yeah.
And he found the stage again, and he found big music again. Oftentimes, it really is Tom Petty that ends up saving a person.
My religion is Tom Petty.
I think you're not alone. And that concludes Bob Dylan's Christian Period. Entry 138.AC1631, certificate number 39323 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are all great places for you to post your own Dylan-related material and thoughts.
Tell us what we got wrong. That's what you know what I love? Is when dedicated fans of an artist.
If you disagree with Ken's or my opinions about Bob Dylan, please write a long, involved letter in cursive.
Send us copies of your Dylan zine.
And mail it to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. You can go to our tweets, which will be Dylan Free, presumably, at Omnibus Project. And you can go to at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick to read our tweets, which are probably going to have some Dylan content after this episode airs. You can also go to my Instagram account and see what kind of sexy business I'm up to.
Is that what it's for?
Rawr. No, it's usually just taking pictures of manhole covers.
That's sexy business.
Yeah.
Depends on what kind of manhole, I guess.
Thanks. Oof. Hit that bell for me, will you?
Why do I have the bell? There we go. I think it's the first time I've ever done that.
Yeah, that's good, though.
It feels does good. Feel good. Yeah.
Especially to reward your own bad, dirty joke.
Someone sent us, by the way, this is from the P.O. box. Someone sent us this new bell because I think they were mad that the bell had disappeared.
New old bell.
Yes, they bought it from an antique store in Olympia, Washington. They also sent us a picture of their great-grandfather delivering mail on some kind of motorbike in 1912.
Let me tell you what kind of motorbike that is. Oh, boy, that's even before... No, that's probably some early Harley-Davidson, right?
He doesn't know. Wow. He says, my great-grandfather was a rural mail carrier in Selah, Washington on a Harley, Indian. He doesn't know. But he
Selah. It's Selah, Washington. Oh, how long Selah. Have you lived in this state?
I never have to say it.
Oh, right.
But I've driven through it, so I guess I said it wrong.
It's Selah, but my cousin Sarah in the 80s changed her name to Selah because she went to Yale and decided that she needed to punish her parents for something.
She spelled it the Hebrew way, S-E-L-A-H?
Or? Yeah. So and the thing is, like, we have family that lives in Selah, so that's where she got the name, but she pronounces it Selah. But the town is Selah. And I didn't mean to characterize my cousin's adoption of the name Selah as something she did just because she went to Yale and wanted to punish her parents. I'm sure she had other motivations.
That's probably a huge part of it,
though. Selah, if you are listening to the show... I apologize. Although you did insult my piano one time, so.
She hasn't gone back to Sarah?
No.
Okay. Well, this person sent us the bell that he found at an antique shop in Olympia. He says he doesn't know the provenance, but you're pretty sure. It's from the card game Pit.
It's
right?
From Pit, yeah. And that one has faded, so it's nice. It's nice. It will find a place of pride in our show.
It is a beautiful Fiesta Ware kind of orange.
Yeah. Futurelings, you may also, or I suggest you do, go onto Facebook, which by the time you are waving your sentient fronds, Facebook is probably the one world government and religion.
Yeah, you probably had a Facebook account when you were born.
Go to that self-same Facebook and join the Futurelings, which is a ribald group of enthusiasts. And add your tentacle to the pile.
We appreciate their input.
And you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
Listeners, from our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization is likely to survive. Hal Lindsey was wrong about the early 80s, but he's still alive, so I'm sure he's still hoping any day now. We hope and pray that the catastrophe that Hal fears may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word to you. But we sincerely hope that Providence will allow us to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.